Okay, good afternoon, everyone. I'm Sabina Dietrich at the University Center for Social and Urban Research and professor here at ICFIA. And we're happy to welcome Lisa Hollingsworth-Centity, who is going to be talking to us about a title that's got the word infrastructure, obsolete, and resilient all in it. So we're going to be looking at community infrastructure and her work also, of course, with American Rivers. Lisa is the Associate Director for River Restoration, working in the American Rivers PA Field Office. She's out and about since 2008 and works to restore rivers to provide resiliency, ecosystem services, habitat, connectivity, public safety, and recreation across the stream, barrier removals, and corridor restoration. She's been the project manager for more than 75 dam removals. Hence our obsolete infrastructure and full culvert replacement projects. She's been a guest lecturer at many, many institutions and universities, and her previous work was in public, private, nonprofit, and academic positions. Her education includes an undergraduate degree in geology and graduate degree in hydrology. Lisa's a storyteller. She's an Edgewood resident. The Edgewood Volunteer Fire Company, and many of you also know her husband, Jim, who teaches some courses for us in planning. Lisa's AICP, and welcome, Lisa.
Thank you. Thank you. It's good to be here. So as Sabina mentioned, I've got all those buzzwords in there. That's a clue that there is something for everyone in this presentation. At least that's the way I put it together. So I'll go through my remarks, and you know, if you have a question, I'm happy to stop, or if you want to wait until the end and have questions then, that's fine. I tried to put enough stuff in here that it would be interesting and give you a full story, but also give you some ideas to ask about. So let's go ahead and get started. Just to tell you a little bit about American Rivers, we're a national nonprofit. We focus exclusively on river health. We are a membership organization. So we have about 200,000 members that send us a little money every month or give us a gift at the end of the year or whatever works out for them. And we put their money to work together with other grants and programs that we have, and we focus specifically on protecting wild rivers, on restoring damaged rivers, and providing clean water for people and for nature. So we do national river cleanups. We are highly involved in policy. Sometimes it's recreational policy, but also conservation policy, environmental infrastructure, anything that has to do with rivers, we're involved with it at the national and certainly at the state level as well. And then dam removal, which is one of our high visibility on-the-ground projects that we're involved with. And as Sabina mentioned, I've been doing dam removals in Pennsylvania for almost 8 years now. So let's talk a little bit about, since we're going to focus sort of on infrastructure, and I'm looking specifically at dams and stream barriers as a component of infrastructure, let's sort of agree on some basics. It's okay, come on in. So when we look at hard infrastructure, we have to recognize it has a design capacity. And if you exceed that capacity, you run the risk of failure. It also has a design life. And when that lifespan has been exhausted, the structure is at risk for failure. Hard infrastructure has to be maintained. You can't just build it once and then ignore it for its design life. We're sort of facing that now. I think I saw something on Facebook about 1,000 bridges in Pittsburgh that are not able to meet the capacity that they were designed to hold, and it's strictly because they've exceeded their design life and the vehicles that we're trying to put on it are heavier than what the bridges can maintain. And then hard infrastructure lacks the ability to provide services at multiple performance levels. Generally, when you design something, it functions best at its particular design capacity. If you try to have it function at some other range, you're going to run into problems. Now let's talk a little bit about resilience. Sort of a basic definition, working definition that the community that works in community resilience and climate change is that resilience is the ability to perform during changing conditions without experiencing irreparable damage. So it can bend but not break, kind of a response. The best resilient facilities mimic natural systems. They provide multiple benefits. They require less maintenance than the traditional hard infrastructure counterpart, and they minimize catastrophe-related impacts. So that's one of the reasons that we're looking at resilience. We're trying to find ways to be able to function effectively through a variety of conditions. So let's talk a little bit about resilience or the lack thereof. And I know this has been in the press in the past couple of weeks, and it's an ongoing catastrophe. Oroville Dam
is the highest dam?
The highest dam in the United States. And it's one of the younger dams. You know, usually dams have a design life of 50 years. It was finished in 1968. Part of the problem is that the spillway has never been used until this particular storm event. They never had enough water that was in it. This is a situation where you're building a large dam to store water in a very dry environment. And so consequently, you know, they built it. Why would we need to do any maintenance on a facility that hasn't really been used in, 40 years? So we have these challenging conditions that are due specifically to climate change. And now all of a sudden we realize that, oh, this thing is not functioning as it should. The problem is when you build a flood, and this dam was actually built for purposes of flood control, water supply, and hydropower. So three federal purposes that it provides. It's actually set up to do what it's supposed to do. In terms of hanging on to that water and making certain that it isn't all released down into the valley at one time. But because that dam was there, it actually encouraged people to build in the floodplain below it because, oh, well, we're safe. This is a controlled river. So we've actually had some things that have gone on that are not resilient and not sustainable because we built this infrastructure in place.
Functioning as it should.
Well, this is where it's not functioning. Yeah, and there was evidently some inspections that went on about 10 years ago, and they found some cracks in the spillway. This is the primary spillway, which is right here. It's this feature right here. There's also an emergency spillway that if the primary spillway were to fail, you can still evacuate some of that water before it were to undercut that dam and just take it totally out. A catastrophic failure like that would, billions of dollars of damage downstream because so many communities have built below. So the cracks 10 years ago, people looked at it and said, we're never going to need that spillway. We get 4 inches of rainfall a year. You know, we're doing all we can to store water. We're not going to be releasing any over that spillway. Don't worry about it. Well, when you get a crack in a facility like that, it's just like a crack in street pavement. And so basically what happened is you got a big pothole that formed right here. And the more that pothole, you know, the crack, then the water gets in, it erodes the soil out from under it and makes it bigger, then it cracks more, and then it makes it bigger, and it cracks, you know, and finally you get this catastrophic situation. And it's...
So Lisa, what we're looking at there is like around where the one is?
Yes. Okay. This damage, this failure right here is right there. Exactly.
Wow.
So, and this is a close-up of what it looked like after about 5 days of water flowing through it.
Yeah.
Right. So they were taking water through the they've got a powerhouse over here. They were taking water through it as quickly as they could. They were taking water through it over here. They found when it got to a certain height it went over the emergency spillway. But this is an unarmored spillway. And it's actually tied into the edge of the dam over here. So if you let too much water go over the emergency spillway, they had not actually, because they didn't believe it would ever happen, nobody actually plotted the route that that overland flow would take. So they weren't sure where it was really going to go and how much, how many more houses they were going to put and families they were going to put in danger. So it's, this is really a, shines a big flashlight on the limitations of our current hard infrastructure. We really haven't planned properly. Yeah.
Can you go over to the emergency spillway and just point to us where the water eventually...
The water is eventually supposed to go down into the Feather River down here.
Yeah.
But the problem is they weren't sure if it was going to go over here.
Did it go over
they
there?
They weren't sure if it was going to go back over into the spillway. I don't, I think the photos that I saw, it actually sort of did take this
did
path.
Did take the room you got platted there.
Right. Okay. So that was kind of what people thought would happen, but nobody had actually planned that out. Now, in Pennsylvania, we have, for our high-hazard dams, which means if the dam were to break, it would kill somebody. High-hazard dams in Pennsylvania are required to have what's called an emergency action plan, an EAP. And that's done by a registered professional geologist in engineer in Pennsylvania, and it has to be approved by Department of Environmental Protection, Dam Safety Division. And an EAP basically looks at what would happen under the scenario of a dam failure. Who would be impacted? Getting a warning system in place so that you can get those people out. High-hazard dams have a more accelerated and more frequent and more rigorous inspection standard so that you can find some of these problems earlier and give buy yourself time. Once a dam starts to fail, you can't really stop it from failing. All you can do is give yourself as much time as possible to get people out of harm's way. And so that's the situation that they had here. And of course, a lot of people who are, you know, spent several days in shelters were a little upset because nobody could give them any answers. And they were reluctant to let people go back home knowing that there was another storm that was supposed to be coming in this weekend. So I do know that they let people go back home, but I don't know what the conditions are. We have staff on the ground in California, and American Rivers has been pretty engaged with the media. And if you go to our website, which is AmericanRivers.org, we have some really good blogs that talk about how this whole situation happened. Okay? Okay, so let's talk about some other problems that we have. South Carolina. We had basically 2 years of back-to-back hurricanes that in 2015, and I can't remember the name of the hurricane, there were 56 dams that failed. Most of these were large dams for amenity reservoirs in subdivisions. So these were dams that were built in the 50s, 60s, 70s. They were not terribly old, but... they were not particularly resilient either, and what happened was a lot of these dams didn't have an adequate spillway for the amount of rain that happened. Remember I said that designed hard infrastructure facilities have a design capacity. And when you exceed the design capacity, what happens is the structure fails, and that's what happened here. When we design dams, we generally design them to withstand a 100-year storm. But when you get a 500-year storm, those facilities can't manage. Another thing that's very interesting, too, is this earthen dam. You see, it's just a pile of dirt. It's a berm. There's no concrete core. There's no clay liner in it. There's nothing that really would have been good design and good construction practice that would have helped that dam maintain. And so consequently, when those dams failed, we wind up with basically the river returning itself to a river. And then this is the area that was submerged. And all of these are not ducks or geese, those are tree trunks. So they basically went in, chopped down all the trees, and then built the dam and flooded the impoundment. So this is this represents an opportunity now to make some decisions. Do we want this amenity lake back? What storm do we build it for? Some people would say, oh, well, we've had our 100-year flood. We're good for 99 more years. A 100-year flood means you have a 1% chance in any year, right, to have that storm. I did a little research for some work I was doing here in Pittsburgh a few years ago and looked at 40 years worth of rainfall data and discovered that the 100-year storm has happened in Pittsburgh about once every decade. So you can't just, we need to be careful the language that we use because it gives people the wrong idea. So then 2016, Hurricane Matthew came through, and there were 40 more dams that failed. So at this point, we've had 100 dam failures in South Carolina. We clearly have some work to do there. One of the things that they found in looking at the situation is that South Carolina really did not have a good dam safety program. They were not inspecting dams. And a lot of it had to do with how they define a dam. In Pennsylvania, a dam is anything over 3 feet tall that is a barrier in a stream. In Georgia, a regulated dam is anything over 25 feet tall. In South Carolina, I think they have a really high threshold for what a dam is. And so a lot of these dams that are on the landscape in other parts of the country aren't even being inspected. They're not even being monitored. So how do you know if it's a problem? Well, you don't until it fails. That's not sustainable and that's not resilient. So we're actually working with South Carolina trying to bring their dam safety standards up to the 21st century. And they're kicking and screaming to do it. So, because politically, you know, people want to sell lakefront property. Yeah, exactly. And I grew up on an amenity lake like this, and there's that part of me that I could support that. You know, I would like people to have their lakes. But the professional in me realizes that that's probably the last thing that a group of homeowners needs to deal with. Okay, so let's circle back around to Pennsylvania and see what we're dealing with. We've got approximately 3,000 regulated dams in Pennsylvania, and those would be dams that are over 3 feet in height. Only 1% of those provide hydropower. You know, a lot of people think, oh, we have to have dams so we can have hydropower. Very few dams, and this is really reflective of what's going on in the country as well. Only 5% of those dams provide flood control. And we'll talk a little bit about the difference between dams providing storage and those that don't. But that's something that people really don't understand. Oh, if I've got a dam up above me, I should be protected. Well, maybe, and maybe not. And the other thing, too, is you're putting your faith in hard infrastructure. And if its capacity is exceeded, it's worse than not having it there at all. 75% of our dams in Pennsylvania are small, less than 25 feet high. Most of them are privately owned. So that means that we are regulating structures that could have an impact on public safety and on the ecosystem, and they're on private land. So, you know, we run into some issues with that. 2% of the dams are orphaned, which means nobody owns them at all. And under Pennsylvania statute, that means that the dam safety is responsible for them. Those are plum projects because the state doesn't want to own crappy dams. They're happy for me to go get those out for them. So we have an awful lot of dams that are greater than 75 years in age. And a lot of them are 100 years old, 150 years old, and even 200 years old. And we find dams that we didn't know about every single year. So there may be as many as 2,000 more dams on the landscape than what we're actually regulating at this point. So it makes life very interesting. So this is the realm in which I am working in Pennsylvania. So let's talk a little bit about how a dam actually impacts the ecosystem. So what we're starting off here with is a natural free-flowing river. You can see it's, back up. I pushed the wrong button. So we've got nice natural substrate on the bottom. We've got a flow that expands and contracts with the amount of rainfall runoff and that sort of thing. It can get up into the floodplain when it needs to. It can stay in the channel when there's less water. And we have these incredible native species that provide this complex food web, and you know, everything is good. They can move up and down the stream. They can use, and what natural or what native species do is they actually wait for flows to trigger their reproductive cycle. So you know, when we have spring thaw and the water is running high, then certain species of fish run upstream and go lay eggs. Other species look for low water, and it just depends on the particular species and what their needs are. So then we build a dam, and you see what happens. The first thing is that we're changing the elevation of the water here, and we're also changing access. These fish don't get up past that dam. And I've literally seen fish bumping their noses at dams. And these are not salmon. These are smallmouth bass. These are creek chub. These are brook trout that literally swim and dash themselves into the dam trying to get upstream. So they can't go anywhere. And because you get the what I call the bathtub effect or the kiddie pool effect up here, the water starts to warm up. So when you put a dam in a stream and you create an impounded area behind it, then it's like taking your kiddie pool out and putting it in the sunshine, and you fill it up with the hose, and the water is so cold that nobody wants to get in it. But after a while, when the sun shines on it, the water warms up. The same thing happens in impoundments. So with the water warming up, and also the water is slowed down now because it can't get over that barrier, so we get a sediment wedge that builds up behind the dam. So now all of a sudden we've got a loss of habitat because all of this nice complex habitat is now been buried in fine material. And we start getting invasive species that like warmer, slower water and finer substrates. Now this stuff looks suspiciously like corn. And then we start getting aquatic species, fish and other vertebrates that are very happy living in this new ecosystem that we're basically creating that's nothing at all like what a river was. And most of the time, they can outcompete the native species because the native species are now weaker. They're not finding the food they need. They're not finding the water temperature they need. They're not finding the oxygen they need. They're way less tolerant. And so the species are really happy there. So what we find is that we've got this entire ecosystem change. We've taken a river and we've converted it completely. We've altered every single thing about it. We've fragmented the habitat so that native species can't reach the smaller stream orders to be able to reproduce. We've warmed the water. When the water is warm, the dissolved oxygen goes down. It's an inverse relationship. We've inundated the river habitat. The floodplain that the river would normally use during high flows is already occupied. So when high flows come, then you're going to have an even larger flooded area behind that dam. You've starved this area down below here of the appropriate sediment. This fine stuff should be coming through in pulses, and it's not any longer. So that, not only are you starving the sediment downstream, but when you alter the habitat, you also alter the access for invertebrates that the fish would normally eat. And then you change the flow regime. You go from a free-flowing stream to one that's stagnant, backwatered, slower, and it just creates this whole cascade effect in the environment. So let's talk a little bit about low-head dams versus storage dams. A low-head dam means that you only raise the head of the water a small amount, And what you have is basically the top of the dam acts like a weir, and water goes over it. So you're not storing any water back here. You are raising the elevation of the water a little bit, but water goes over that dam all the time. As compared to a storage dam, where you actually are holding water back, this is more water than would be in the stream at any given time. And this is the Hoover Dam, sort of one of our iconic water storage dams. So we would store water if we wanted water supply. We would store water if we wanted to turn turbines. We would store water when we have high flood events, high flow events, so that we release the water more slowly and it's not a big pulse of water going down and damaging homes and communities and things. We use these kind of dams for water supply as well. An example would be you would put in a pipe and you would just pull that water because it's a little bit higher. You would put in an intake structure in the stream bank, and this dam there would raise the water enough to make sure that that intake structure is flooded. But that's a really important distinction to make between low head dams and what we call storage dams. So, which do you think is most damaging to the environment? A low head dam or a storage dam? Any ideas?
Go ahead, Dave. Storage dam?
Actually, they're both damaging.
And that's
the interesting thing. People say, oh, it's just a little dam, it doesn't cause any problems. A small dam in a stream, especially if the stream is a high resource, it can be just as damaging as a big dam. The size of the dam does not equate to the impact in the ecosystem and on the landscape. It also does not equate to public safety damage, public safety hazards, because people see this and this as a waterfall. It's something to go out and play on. And what we run into is people who can't see because they're out on the water. This is a very small drop. It doesn't look like anything, but low head dams are very symmetrical features. They're not like waterfalls at all. Waterfalls are irregular. And a low head dam is going to be very, very uniform. And that sets up a situation where you've got a hydraulic, or some people call it a roller, some people call it a boil. But what happens is you get caught in that boil and you cannot get out unless you swim parallel to it. And low head dams are drowning machines. Pennsylvania is number 2 in the nation and has been for the past 25 years in the number of dam-related drownings. And it's because people have no idea that these things are so dangerous. Oh, it's a play feature. I can just go over it. I can ignore that sign 200 feet back that says, dam, stay back. I'm just going to go over it in my kayak. And then, or I'm going to play on it. As you see, these people are out here treating this as their private swimming hole. And it's not a matter of if somebody drowns, it's a matter of when someone drowns, because it will happen. The other thing is these things get slippery. It's unbelievable. And people think, oh, well, there's just, you know, the water's only knee-deep going over the top of the dam. I can walk on that. Well, I know from personal experience, your feet can be swept out from under you in water that's knee-deep. If it's moving, and if it's moving quickly over the top of the dam, you can lose your footing in a heartbeat. Okay, and this is how fish see the issue. If you can't read this, just because you can't get it upstream anymore doesn't mean you have to stop spawning, Bob. There's a new drug out there that helps aging salmon with that problem. It works on streams and rivers and waterfalls. It's called Niagara. So, you know, a lot of people claim that American Rivers is too fish-centric, that we put way too much effort on the fish. But honestly, if a river is not good for fish to live in, do we really want to recreate in it? Do we really want to drink out of it? You know, we can treat fish as our canary in the coal mine. So having fish be able to use the stream and use all of the stream keeps everything in balance and only works when the rivers are very healthy. Another interesting creature, freshwater mussels. You may have been out in streams in the country when you were a kid, and you've seen these things that look like clams. These are freshwater mussels. Freshwater mussels are critical because they provide an ecosystem service. One animal, depending on the type of animal, filters between 18 and 45 gallons of water a day. So if you've got a healthy mussel population in your stream, you are going to have good water quality. End of discussion. So, and it's also interesting that freshwater mussels bioaccumulate metals. That's one of the reasons that if you're low in trace metals like selenium and zinc and other things, people tell you to eat shellfish because they attenuate that or bioaccumulate those materials in their flesh. And Pennsylvania has the greatest biodiversity of freshwater mussels of any state east of the Mississippi. It's just incredible. We have about 17 threatened and endangered species that call the Allegheny River their home. And the cool thing about freshwater mussels is that they actually require fish to complete their life cycle. And this is a freshwater mussel up here. This is not a fish sitting on top of it. This is what they call an egg lure. And so when a freshwater mussel is ready to reproduce, they put this egg lure out there, and it draws a specific fish that they use to reproduce with. Each freshwater mussel has a certain fish that they associate with. And the fish will come forward here thinking this is something to eat. The mussel will open up a little wider, grab the fish, pull it closer, and spray the eggs into the mouth of the fish. They go straight to the gills, and they become parasitic. And they stay there for 4 to 6 months, and then the freshwater mussels drop off, start secreting a shell, and begin their life as a benthic organism, in other words, staying on the bottom. And they filter feed regularly. Here's one with getting ready to put his feeding apparatus out into the water to filter feed. So they're amazing creatures. We find them in the geologic record all the way back to Ordovician times, which is like 550, 600 million years ago. So that makes them extremely successful as an organism. But if we keep screwing up our rivers and blocking habitat, we're going to lose these very important creatures that are the base of the food web and also provide the water quality that we depend on. So, I've told you a lot about dams and the damage they do, and clearly I've done a lot of work with dam removals. A lot of people think, well, I've never heard of dams being removed. Well, we've been doing it for quite a while. In 1963, this dam came out of Idaho. I don't know the details of why they chose to take it out. My guess is probably it was too expensive to repair. That's the bulk of the reason why we take out dams. So let's talk about why we would want to do that. We have two categories of benefits, and American Rivers quantifies both of these before we go forward with a dam removal project, because when we're looking at conservation investments, we have to count. We have to be able to quantify the benefits that we create. So under the ecological side, we restore the stream's natural form and function. The river can do what it was made to do. We reconnect aquatic habitat. That's for fish and other species. In addition, we reconnect the riparian habitat, the nearshore areas, for terrestrial species, for amphibians, and other species that use that river as a corridor. We provide natural flows, which in turn the natural flows help to replenish the whole hydrologic system, but they also provide those triggering flows that make certain that we have the wildlife reproducing. We improve the thermal profile and the dissolved oxygens. We reconnect floodplains. We reestablish a riparian corridor, which provides additional habitat but also helps keep the stream cool. And we provide climate change resilience. Because here again, with the dam not in place, the stream can expand and contract with whatever the weather conditions are. On the community side, cost. Because as I said earlier, you can't just build a piece of infrastructure and then ignore it for its life. You need to maintain it. You need to inspect that dam routinely and make certain that it's still in good condition. Eliminating liability. I mentioned dams being drowning machines. I'm going to show you a dam that we took out a while ago because the community that owned it was about to lose their liability insurance because someone had drowned at the dam. So it's, you know, it's just a practical matter. Retiring obsolete infrastructure. If it's not serving a purpose and it's causing degradation, why would you leave it there? But what we find is a lot of these dams have just been abandoned on the landscape. Improving public safety from the standpoint of flood risk reduction as well as access. You know, people climbing around on the dam, thinking it's a waterfall, it's a great place to stand on top of and fish, but people drown that way. They fall and get hurt. The people who own the dams are liable for that. Reducing flood risk. I talked about that a little bit earlier, and I'll show you an example. Recreational and economic benefits. If you've got let's take Loyalhanna Creek, for example, in Westmoreland County. It goes through the gorge where US 30 is there between Latrobe and Lingadier. And if you're taking your kayak down that beautiful scenic river and you get to Kingston, you're going to have to get out of your kayak, pull it to the side, pull it up the stream banks, walk it down the road next to US 30, and put it back in below the dam. A lot of kayakers are like, oh, I don't need to worry about that. I'll just go. Well, you can't go over. You just can't go over all the dams. It's really dangerous, and a lot of people have been hurt that way. And then increasing property values. Now, a lot of people might find this counterintuitive. Oh, I have a lake. My property value is increased. Actually, because of the liability associated with owning a dam and with the potential for drowning in deep, still water, we find that a free-flowing stream next to a parcel of land makes that land worth anywhere from 10 to 30% more than if that land is sitting on an impoundment. So, common concerns about dam removal, because when you start talking about, people, we're coming for your dams, people get a little upset. And that's primarily because we fear change. And so because we fear change, we like things the way they are, then we throw a lot of roadblocks in the way to try to stop it. And so these are a lot of the concerns that I've heard in public meetings and even just sitting across from people at a coffee shop talking about, what we're going to do. We'll be left with a stinking mud flat. And, I showed you that picture of the breach dams in South Carolina where all you saw was mud and tree stumps. Well, the answer to that is yes, temporarily, but it's not going to be that way forever. We plant things in the former impounded area. We plant native species, trees, shrubs, wildflowers, and within a growing season, you have an entirely new area next to the stream. The river will dry up without the dam. Really? Especially in a case of a low head dam, where the water that's in the stream goes over the dam. So the water that's there is the water that's there, whether the dam is present or not. But I've actually had people get up in public meetings and testify that if you take out that low head dam, the river will end. It will not be there anymore. It's really hard to argue with people about that because they're convinced. They know it. Never mind that the river was there before the dam was built. So what about the ducks and the bass and the plants? Well, the answer is you're still going to have ducks. I see ducks on free-flowing streams all the time. The bass are not going to be happy in a free-flowing stream. But you're going to have native species. You're going to have smallmouth bass instead of largemouth. You're going to have other fish that would normally live in that river without the dam. Plants, by golly, I hope we have plants, but they're going to be native species. They're not going to be invasives. We're going to make certain that what we plant there is sustainable and appropriate. Flooding will increase if you take that dam out. Well, if it's not a flood control dam, you're not changing. Actually, you're making flooding worse with a low head dam upstream of the dam because you're already occupying the floodplain with water, which means that high flows have to go somewhere. So they go beyond the floodplain and actually make a larger area. Property values will diminish. Well, no, we have studies that show that property values actually increase. Well, there won't be any more fish. Well, that's true, sort of, because fish are stopping down here and bumping their nose against the dam. It's like fishing in a barrel. What fun is that? You know, let's open the dam up and you'll get bigger fish and more fish because they'll have the ability to reproduce. But the dam is historic. And we have a lot of historic dams in Pennsylvania. Some of our dams were built when during colonial era, especially the ones in eastern Pennsylvania. We have dams, beautiful cut stone dams that were built by CCC camp people. But the mill that the dam powered is not there anymore. So you've lost your historic context. In some cases, we preserve a piece of the dam so that people can see how it was built. And we put up an interpretive sign so that people can see what was there. And then we also explain why it was important to the river to take that dam down. So we have some opportunities to honor our history, but we're also honoring our natural history, which is way longer than our cultural history. Now, one of the things that I use to help explain the changes that are going to happen is before and after photos. And I've got handouts that have tens of these from not only Pennsylvania, but around the country as well. I could probably put together hundreds, but nobody would take the time to look at it. So before and after photos, this is a picture of the Harmony Junction Dam on Conequenessing Creek outside of Zelianople. It was used to provide electricity for the Pittsburgh Short Line Railroad, but that use ended in the 1940s. And so it's been sitting out there abandoned on the landscape. You see this high wall here. People would stand up here and fish, which was really dangerous because it was about a 20-foot drop down to the water. People would get out here and walk on this very slippery crest of the dam. Yeah, you could catch a whole lot of fish down here, but they weren't able to get upstream to do their fish thing. So after we took the dam out, you can see, we don't have a lot of things growing here, but it doesn't stop people from coming out here and fishing. It's still a favorite fishing hole. And then the next year when we have vegetation in place and we worked with Wild Waterways Conservancy, and they preferred wildflowers on the site. We also added a canoe and kayak launch. This is a great facility. You can get out here on this little sandbar and fish to your heart's content. And another opportunity that we have is connecting the community to the river. You know, a lot of communities, you know, the dam is down there. We haven't really gone down there in a while. The mill is gone, or whatever is present has really stopped us from using the river in that case. But let's not just remove a dam. Let's get the community involved and talk to them about what that land can be. Maybe the found land that's now submerged underwater can become a park. Maybe it can become a greenway. Maybe you can put in bioswales and rain gardens. Maybe you can put in a riparian corridor and provide the river with soft green edges that it needs. Economic revitalization. Green space in a community equals higher economic competitiveness. And getting that opportunity for the citizens to actually get involved. Not we're coming for your dam, but let's make a vibrant downtown riverfront. And get people involved in doing that. Now, another thing that I have to do is provide perspective for people because I'm putting change in front of them. And we really, as human beings, resist change. We don't like it. We like things the way they are.
Lisa, now, you want to read that sign for the people that can't see it?
The sign says, take a second to say goodbye to the lake. The mud hole you'll see is sponsored by the DNR. And as you can see, it's in...
That's a Department of Natural Resources. State Department of Natural Resources, for those of you that...
Right.
Yeah.
And of course, you see the kind of boats that would be on lakes. So this is a marina. And the marina is convinced that when the dam is gone, recreational opportunities will be gone. And that's not true. There may be a shift in recreational opportunities. There may be better times and worse times of the year to boat. But there's always better times and worse times of the year to boat. And chances are you're going to have more length of river to boat if the dam is not there. So anyway, but this is somebody saying, oh, all we're going to have is a mud hole when you take this dam out. Well, no, that's not true. If it was only going to ever be a mud hole, we would never be able to get a permit to do that kind of work. So the first thing you have to figure out is what is it people are upset about and get in front of that. These guys, this is at Trafford, Pennsylvania, on the site of the old Westinghouse plant. That's a brownfield, and it's been redeveloped with soccer fields and various things. These guys love to fish in this hole, and they were standing on this. It's literally 25 feet down to the water there. It made me dizzy. If you're out there and you're watching the water move, it's a recipe for danger. They were very concerned about what were going to happen to the fish once we took the dam out. Well, some of them are going to move upstream and some of them are not. Well, what if we caught them and we moved them to our fishing pond that our buddy has? I said, sure, go ahead. You know, if you want to salvage those fish before we take the dam out, that's fine. They were completely happy with that. I gave them an opportunity to preserve the fish that they loved and put them in an environment that they'd be happier in. Understand how the public sees the dam. Is that where they learn to fish? Is that where they learn to swim? Is that where they used to go pitch rocks when they were kids and play, you know, and use rocks and build little dams themselves? You know, how are they connected to it emotionally? And how can you show them that they're going to get something else that might be equally relevant or even more relevant to them now? An example of this one is that a lot of people would swim here. This was the de facto swimming hole for the people in Trafford. Well, it's 14 feet deep, and the dam is undercut, which means if you get caught in the roller, you're going to be pushed under the edge of the concrete, and you won't be able to escape. Also, Alcosan put a nice CSO outfall right here below, and it stinks. It's not a place to swim anymore. You know, when it was back in the 1920s, sure, probably the water was clean enough. It's not clean enough now. And there are signs up that say, Alcosan CSO outfall, don't swim here. You know, if your nose can't get your attention, maybe the sign will. So, you know, we have to look at how has this river changed as a result of the dam being there, as the result of urbanization, other things that have happened on the stream, and how can we use dam removal as an opportunity to reverse that and give you something that now will improve your quality of life? And making that sell is the important piece of getting people on board with dam removal. Matching the public process to the context. This is really important. What goes on at a particular dam is not the same from dam to dam, from setting to setting, because you're dealing with different circumstances and different needs. So if you've got a dam in a rural setting versus one in an urban setting, you're going to have more people in the urban setting that could be potentially impacted by change. So you need to design a public process that takes that into account. Is it a private dam versus public ownership or public access? If you're only impacting one person and that person doesn't want that dam, why would you bring the whole community in to fuss at somebody who's going to take a dam off their own property? So, you know, looking at the context and recognizing based on what's around that dam and what that setting is, how can we set this up to be successful and deal with people effectively? potential creation for new land. We've had a lot of dams that were in parks. You take out the dam, you get extra dry land. So now you can do all these other cool things. You can have a river walk. You can have a community garden area. You can have riparian corridors, forested area. There's all kinds of things that can happen. And it's just a matter of looking at the context and deciding what's necessary. And then in some cases, we might not even want to have a public process. And in Pennsylvania, you're not required to have one unless it's going to benefit the project. In other words, why kick a hornet's nest? So we've had cases where a private landowner has let people come onto their property, and the people that come on that property to fish are opposed to the landowner making changes on their own land. It's like, but it's their land. And their if you fall on their dam, you can sue them. Why would the property owner want to cause a lot of uproar in the community? And in some cases, we've really worked hard to help make certain that those landowners are ready emotionally to be able to deal with the outcry if somebody's going to change something. And they just happen to own it. So now I'm kind of changing the subject now, and let's look at what we've got. 1,400 dams have been removed around the country we've been tracking it since 1999. Pennsylvania is the leader again, 14 years in a row. And we just have updated our website we set out our award yesterday, our notice yesterday of the number of dams removed in 2016. So you can go to our website if you're interested in knowing more about dam removals and where they've happened. And this is an interactive map that we've put together. This is what it looked like before we issued the new information yesterday. So when you go, you'll see something a little different. So you can see tons and tons of dams that have been taken out.
What's the difference between the green and the red dots?
The green ones were the ones that were taken out that year.
Oh, okay.
So if you wanted to zoom, you can zoom in on Pennsylvania. And I actually highlighted this dam, which pops up here. And you can see, it'll pull out a drop-down menu here, and you can find out what's the name of the dam, when was it removed, where is it, what's the river, how high was the dam. So we try to track as much information as possible. There's other more detailed data that's not necessarily available on this, but if you're interested in it, I can get it for you. So yeah, you see these two are shown in green, and this one. Those dams would have been removed in 2015. But we show the whole area. And then there's my project that I took out in 2015 as well. So there's a lot of really cool data. And even though we've removed 1,400 dams, we have 100,000, we think, on the landscape. So we're not in danger of taking out all our dams anytime soon. So the next question you might ask is, well, how do you choose what dam to remove? Remember I mentioned the ecological benefits and the community benefits. We start looking there on any particular project that we consider. There's quite an exhaustive pre-planning phase that we go through. We quantify the potential ecological lift and the community benefits. We highlight and focus on watersheds where there have been previous conservation benefits or investments there. Because if we've done work in a watershed, somebody else has done work in a watershed, if we can add more to that, then we're just improving things. We look at resources and partners available to work in a watershed. We're getting really hard to find single source funding sources for the work that we do. We look for dams that aren't serving a useful purpose because we don't have to spend the money to replace that purpose. And we're looking at finding dams that the owner is willing to let us take them out. If they say no, you know, we can talk to them a little bit, but we can't force them. So we try to educate them. In some cases, I've talked to a dam owner. They weren't willing to take the dam out, but something changes in 3 or 4 years. I can go back around and talk to them again, and now they're interested. So that's kind of an approach I've taken. I use Geographic Information System and compile a lot of information and then do a query and rank high, medium, low. So the HUC-12 watersheds that you see here in red are my high-value watersheds. And within that, then I'm going to look for dams in those watersheds to actually be targets for removal. By targeting watersheds rather than specific dams, I have possibly more than one opportunity to make an improvement on the ground. If I highlight a dam and I put a lot of money into getting that dam ready to come out and the dam owner says no, I have really wasted my resources. So we feel like going for watershed prioritization rather than structure prioritization makes a lot more sense. So let's look at how we take dams out. And I've seen these pictures of, you know, what your friends think you do if you're a community planner, what your parents think you do, what you think you do. So what people think of when I talk about dam removal is that we get out the dynamite and we blow these structures up. But how we mostly do it is very slowly and with mechanical equipment. So just, I'm going to take you on a real brief tour of some of the dams that we've removed. This is the Woodland Dam on Little Sewickley Creek in Edgeworth, Pennsylvania. It's the only high-value stream in Allegheny County that's left. And this structure was a little tiny thing. It was about 3 feet high, but it was very dangerous because it's actually undercut. And there was a drowning here in the 1970s. A guy was mad at his parents, raided their booze cabinet, took it all down there, sat on the dam, drank until he passed out, was washed underneath the dam and drowned. The other thing that you can see here is there's this gigantic wallow hole over here on the side where when the stream gets up, the water is forced over here and it's just eroded the stream bank. Well, there's a road right next to the stream. So where this infrastructure that's not serving a purpose was threatening infrastructure that is serving a purpose. And then here's what the dam looked like when we finally got it out. This is the edge of the dam here. We left it in place because we didn't want to destabilize this really steep bank that was next to the stream. So you can see where we filled in this. I mentioned this wallow hole. The stream bank would originally have been along here. And when we took the dam out, we actually broke it up into pieces and we used it to complete a stream bank restoration. So we removed obsolete infrastructure. The dam was originally built in the 1920s to provide water for someone's swimming pool. And that swimming pool was taken out of service in the 50s. We eliminated a public safety hazard. A lot of parents came by while we were working and said, oh, thank God, I worry about my kids playing in the stream and falling and hurting themselves. And there was rebar sticking out of that dam. It was exceptionally dangerous. We reconnected 17 miles of high-quality stream. That's a huge benefit. We reconnected a habitat for trout, blue-breast darter, which is threatened and endangered. It's also a freshwater mussel host species, and 27 other species of fish. This stream is a direct tributary to the Ohio River, so we have the opportunity to bring river fish upstream for spawning. And then we restored the stream bank to avoid the undercutting of the road. Snare Run Dam removal, 2009. This was a 35-foot high dam that was classified as low hazard, except that five people had gone up there and built their houses within a quarter mile. I know I'm running short on time.
We have enough time for questions.
Yes, exactly. So we did this in several different phases. We had to eliminate the public safety hazard first. So we did that within 4 days because the dam was actively failing when we went up to inspect it that day. You could hear stones falling out of it and hitting. It was pretty scary. And then we went back a year later and we took out the bottom 3 feet of the dam and reconnected it for brook trout. The benefits, we removed a public safety hazard. We phased restoration for fish. It was a great collaboration between partners. This is the dam that I mentioned that Grove City Borough was about to lose their liability insurance over because somebody had fallen on that dam and drowned. Interestingly, we see a lot of dams underneath PennDOT bridges. I don't know why that happened, but it happened a lot in Pennsylvania. And so you can see the before and after of what that dam removal looks like. This was a case where the community, especially Grove City College, was vehemently opposed to dam removal because they didn't want the changes. But what they found now is Dr. Fred Brenner takes his biology students out and they do stream surveys in the new free-flowing stream that flows through Grove City College, and they've been able to document a five-fold increase in biodiversity. And the college has developed a riparian riverwalk next to it, which is far better than the pond that used to be there. Harmony Junction, I showed you this one. When we got this much of the dam out on the first day, fish were jumping, trying to get up because they could see the water coming down in larger volumes. This is what it looked like a year later. You've seen this series of photos already. And I talked to this guy who caught that fish while I was standing out there. And he said, yeah, I hated the idea of this dam leaving, but you were right. The fishing is better. So that was pretty cool. We decreased flooding. We opened 7 miles of stream. We created a water trail there. They don't have to portage around it. So it's a wonderful success story. Now let's talk a little bit about Allegheny Locks and Dams 5 through 9. The Corps of Engineers this week announced that they're going to be doing a disposition study for these five structures. These are navigation dams only. That's their only federal purpose, but they have not had commercial traffic to speak of in the past decade. So they found that they're not meeting their designated federal need, and these dams are in declining condition, and they're concerned about liability and are looking at disposition of these dams. So a disposition study, and this is from the announcement that I received this week. This is the exact language. The goal of the study is to inform Corps headquarters on issues and costs, and they're looking at various management opportunities for these five dams, including keeping the current level of facility maintenance. What's the current level of facility maintenance? Zero. These dams are 80 years old. Their design life was 50 years. Keeping something and not maintaining it is not responsible. Then they're also saying, okay, we're looking at deauthorizing the project with either giving these dams to somebody else. Who wants a failing dam?
Especially if there's no commercial traffic. There's
right,
no,
exactly.
There's no stakeholders left for the dam.
Well, there are stakeholders. The stakeholders are recreation users, which that's not a designated purpose for that dam. And water supply, also not a designated purpose. So legally, there's no requirement for the Corps to maintain those structures for non-designated uses. But politically, what's going to happen if you take somebody's playground away or their water supply? So we have to have some good ways to replace those uses. And that's
can you go back to the map a second?
Sure. Right. This Lock and Dam 5, which is at Freeport. And then this one is the one up at East Brady. Katanning is 7 right there. So you get an idea. Interestingly, at Katanning, at the dam, they have an area at below the dam where they have a band shell and an amphitheater and people go for concerts, and they park their boats and have like a little flotilla party, you know, Saturday night music in the summertime. But where they park their boats is below the dam, not above it. So removing that dam isn't going to change the use of the river in that location. They're still going to be able to have their Saturday night music parties and tie their boats up down there. But we haven't convinced them of that yet. We haven't started convincing them of that yet. So the other thing that the Corps is looking at is deauthorizing the projects, in other words, saying we have no more interest, and giving them to somebody who wants them, abandoning the dams, which means just walking away and leaving stuff in the river, or removing what they say improvements, which would be all the structural pieces. So let me just show you a comparison. This is the Green River in Kentucky. It's right below Mammoth Cave, if you're familiar with that area. The Corps of Engineers did a disposition study for four dams, I think, on the Green River and Barron River systems a couple of years ago. All they did was look at how to eliminate the Corps' liability That's all they looked at. They didn't look at recreation. They didn't look at community access to the river. They didn't look at any of those things. Okay. So while they were trying to decide what to do with this particular dam, because people said, we want to take it out, it failed a couple of months ago. You can see a big chunk that is missing right there. You can see this really funky hydraulic. That's where water is going under the dam. And you notice the water level is high up here. It's at the top of the dam. You see the water level now? This dam is not impounding any water. It has structurally failed. So this is a liability in a lot of ways. And so I think this has accelerated the Corps' interest in getting this particular dam out. We can learn a lot about Allegheny Locks and Dams 5 through 9 by doing something, you know, comparing it to what's going on in Kentucky. Do y'all see any problems with this lock and dam? The lock is, I'm actually standing over here on front of the lock when I took this picture. Can you see any problems in this? I'll point them out. See this crack? Goes all the way across. You can't really see. You can see it over here in this part of the picture. And then the other thing, what's going on here? Yeah. You've got this uniform structure with sheet flow, but you've got your hydraulic down here, and then you've got this weird thing. What's going on over here is the dam is being undercut, which means that the rock underneath it is being eaten away. So this dam is in danger of failure. This is one of the core dams. Leaving it and abandoning it the way it is not acceptable. It's not an option, simply because it's a public safety hazard. It's only going to get worse. It's going to become, you saw what happened to the Green River Lock and Dam 6. It's going to happen here too. It's just a matter of time. So what I'm working on is what I'm calling a recon memo, which is reconnaissance level preliminary feasibility. We're looking at literature, we're looking at field evaluations, and we're comparing our 5 through 9 dams to other dams. We're comparing the cost and the benefits of continued use versus removal, because we feel like those are the only two things. And if you keep it, you have to upgrade it. You have to make it safe. You know, you can't keep this thing without an investment. What are the impacts on aquatic habitat and community? This is not going to be included in the Corps' disposition study. The impacts on continued recreational uses of the river, and that's primarily because the people that are going to object to the dams coming out are the recreational users. And then what about other river uses that those dams have taken into account? So just by comparison, I've heard the Corps mention several times that if we take those dams out, Allegheny Locks and Dams 5 through 9, the river will only be 18 inches deep. Well, in 1832, keelboats brought materials that came through the St. Lawrence Seaway over to Erie. They were portaged on land. They brought down bacon. They brought down whiskey. They brought down barrels of metal findings. I found this in the Pittsburgh room over at the Carnegie Library. Pretty amazing. And they also floated what they called Allegheny rafts, where they took whole forests and sent them down to New Orleans so that people could build their houses. So the river was a working river long before those locks and dams were in place, and it was a navigable water before those locks and dams were in place. There's no reason to conclude that if we take those dams out, that the river is not going to be usable for boating. It may require some different boating strategies, but it can still happen. So, with that, I'll open it up for questions.
Thanks. I have two questions. One, there used to be an organization, Dynamo. Does that still exist? It was something about, it was a public-private, and it was something they lobby for, I guess, the navigability of the Allegheny Monongahela. That was the MO part of it. I don't remember what DINES, D-I-N-S, stood for. If it still existed, you would know.
I have not heard about that.
Yeah.
But now I want to go look it up and see if I can find another group who would be willing to to you know, help us work on the rivers.
Yeah, I'm not sure they were. I'm not sure they would be an ally. I think they tended to be more in terms of, but it was probably because of steel industry, you know, the entail end of the steel industry.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing I want to ask you, do we have any, is there any potential, you know, Johnstown flood occurrences in the works, would you think, in Pennsylvania?
Well, for one thing, the Johnstown flood happened before we had any kind of dam safety regulations. And the reason it happened is because all the rich people that had their summer homes up on the reservoir actually took that dam partially apart to make it larger. They wanted a bigger lake. So they actually undid some of the structural stuff. And, the, of course, the dam failed because it couldn't withstand the flows that the river received. And then, of course, we built the flood protection dams, and then we had another big flood in the 1970s. Well, that's because, remember what I mentioned, when you exceed capacity, you risk failure. And so that flood, you know, when a flood exceeds the capacity of a dam to hold the water back, you're gonna get those kind of floods. I think given climate change being what it is and creating more uncertainty, creating wetter wets, and drier dries and higher flood volumes, that the chances of us having storms that exceed our flood control capacity are very likely. I mean, that's not good news, but it's the truth of the matter. We don't have flood control dams. I mean, we have a lot of flood control dams in the Allegheny, and a lot of them are on tributaries. The one that's on the main stem is Kinzu. And it's designed to hold back water and release it slowly after the storm so that we don't inundate the city of Pittsburgh. But if it's designed for a 100-year storm and we get a 500-year storm, it's not going to be able to work. And that's just how it is. So in the meantime, we have the National Flood Insurance Program, which says you can build in the floodplain as long as you're insured. But we've really just encouraged people to build in harm's way. I think we really need to look very hard at our pattern of urban development, and we need to find ways to put floodplains back into floodplain use and move people to other places. That's the only way. You know, if people are not in harm's way, they're a whole lot safer than if they're just sitting there waiting until the storm happens.
Are there any dams being built in Pennsylvania anymore?
I am not aware of any at this time. American Rivers actually started in 1973 opposing the Hetch Hetchy Dam in Yosemite Valley. And because of climate change uncertainty, there are a lot of places that are proposing new dams to be built for water supply. And I'm actually on an internal task force where we're looking at the appropriate ways of opposing new dams being built. You know, we probably have all the infrastructure we need. We need to just maintain what we have. We need to upgrade what we have. We don't need to build new. So, you know, so that's, you know, unless somebody can show the costs and benefits and mitigate the damages, and then, you know, that would certainly be something that would be worth considering.
I say, when was the last dam built in Pennsylvania?
Oh, gosh. It might have been Kinzu.
Oh, really?
So built in the 70s?
70s.
Yeah. Yeah, after we started, after the formation of the Environmental Protection Agency and the Endangered Species Act, it became more difficult to build dams. But literally, if you look at our history in the country, we've been building dams every single day since the country was settled. So there's a lot of infrastructure on the landscape.
Yeah, in Pennsylvania, obviously, lots of them were mills. I mean, our legacy of so it has so much water, mm-hmm. and we're old.
Right.
And all those little dams were used for generating some power 200 years ago.
Right. And what we've seen using LIDAR,
yeah.
Dottie Merritts from Franklin and Marshall has actually used LIDAR in some of the stream valleys, and you can see like this progression of there was a small dam here, and when it failed, they moved downstream and built a bigger one. And then that one failed, so they moved downstream and built a bigger one. And that one failed, and they moved downstream, and you know, until...
Yeah.
And so we have this legacy of all of these old dams on our landscape.
Lisa, what's the web page for the interactive map of the current dams and the latest ones that you've had taken out?
Right here, www.americanrivers.org. Let me back up. You can got the whole.
But when you get there, where do you find the?
There's a.
I can get to that. I can't find the.
There it is.
Okay.
americanrivers.org/threats-solutions/restoring-damaged-rivers. It needs to really be more intuitive. /dam removal map.
There's not any obvious link on the page either.
You know, it may be down right now because we're updating our map with the new data from 2016.
Okay.
You update it yearly?
We actually try to do rolling updates. So if we've missed a dam that somebody knows about and they let us know, we'll go in and update it.
Okay.
So, and there should be a blog on our website about the new data on the interactive map. And it should have a link that'll take you to it. But honestly, I haven't had time to try it yet.
Okay.
Okay.
Any questions? Well, thanks so much.
Thank you. I did bring a couple of brochures that are up here by the sign-in. You're welcome to take those. If you want a card, let me know. I'll give you one. Yeah, thanks for being here. Thanks for your attention.